Hello everyone, this is Ronnie on the Loughborough podcast, and we have another fantastic guest today, and that's Wade Lightheart. And Wade is a three-time Canadian natural bodybuilding champion and one of the world's premier authorities in natural nutrition and training methods. He majored in sports science at the University of New Brunswick. He has authored numerous books on health, nutrition, exercise, and is sought out by worldwide by athletes and high-performance orientated individuals. He is the I believe the CEO of BioOptimizers is the company that you...
Yep.
And I believe that's to do with helping with digestion and things like that. And we'll maybe talk about more about that. But Wade, thank you very much for joining us. And is there anything you'd like to say about yourself before we get into it?
That's always a loaded question, right? Would you like to say anything about myself? all I can say is that it's I'm just grateful to be here, and hopefully we can add some elements that I've learned over the course of my career in health and fitness and vitality, how it pertains to transiting in and into a raw food diet. What's the advantages? What are the challenges? And maybe how to help people make a great move if that's one of their intentions.
Awesome. That's fantastic. One thing I would say is that there's a bright light behind you. I don't know.
Yeah. See if I can move that over here.
That we can really see you a lot better now, if that's okay.
There you go.
Excellent.
It's the sun shining through the trees here in my office.
Where is it? Where are you at the moment?
I'm in Venice Beach, California.
Fantastic. Great. I mean, really cool. So, I guess we'll get into the bodybuilding and that aspect of it, because there's a lot of people that obviously would question whether someone could be a builder on even a vegetarian diet, vegan diet, whatever. But where did it start off for you? Did you grow up on a totally conventional diet or something a little bit different?
Yeah. So, I grew up in New Brunswick, Canada, which is close to U.S. border of Maine on the East Coast. So a northern country, you got 6 months of winter basically. And I had a couple advantages and a couple, unknowns. My parents always grew a garden. That was common, I think. So I had the advantage of understanding how food is actually produced and grown. We ate a lot of local livestock. That was part of the culture and how things worked in a northern type community. And then, I remember in my teenage years when my mother, who was moving to organic food, she wasn't using pesticides and fertilizers and things. We kind of thought she was odd, and she said, "Don't use the microwave." And we thought that was odd, and we didn't understand that. And then I had the unique experience when I went to university to study exercise physiology. I was struck how the food at the university made me feel different. And then I'd come home in the summers and I ate my more traditional homegrown food. And I was like, there might be something to what my mother's saying here, right? I could see a physiological difference in myself with energy and sleep patterns and things like that. And really the difference was chemicalized food versus non-chemicalized food. Wow. I was like, okay, well, that was a discovery. At that time, in around 1990, the bodybuilding community, I had played hockey and stuff like that, kind of reached the zenith of my career there, and then had been working out for a few years just because to get bigger and stronger for the sport. But I fell in love with the bodybuilding bug. And of course, was reading books from Arnold Schwarzenegger and things like that. And they told you needed to eat, 1 gram per pound of body weight and lots of meat and all this sort of stuff. And I did all that stuff, went and trained and started to having success in competitions and et cetera. And most of the dietary philosophy back then was focused on macros, your protein, your carbohydrates, your fats, almost zero mention of fiber. Supplements were very low quality. Most of them had no science behind them. It was just hopes in a bottle. And that's where the world was back then. And accessibility of information and stuff was very low. And so whenever we look at maybe this is an overarching thing is, first of all, your nutrition knowledge is not it's not static if you're continuing in a field. The second thing is that people are highly influenced by the culture that they live in, and they tend to seek out reaffirmation of that. And as they move into another culture, that which they identify with before or become common, there'll be what appears to be inevitable conflicts in thinking and feeling or within the social structure, which can be distressful. And this is, I can't underestimate this to people who are considering moving to a plant-based or a raw food diet, because it's just not as common in the world or in the advocacy of very nutritional protocols. And so people, it's very hard to get past their own biases. And I experienced all that sort of stuff. We didn't know about raw food or anything like that. That was a fairly wild conceptualization. But as I moved through my career and ended up becoming a personal trainer and fitness advocate, I got into Eastern philosophy and meditation, spent time in ashrams and things like that, and found out that there was in the Indian culture, becoming a vegetarian was actually more common than not being a vegetarian. And so this opened up a whole new vista of questions and conflicts in my mind. It's like, well, how's that possible? And and around 2000, so I'd be in my around 28, 29, I had decided that I would experiment with a plant-based diet. I read a book called The Holy Science. Changed my life. And The Holy Science was written by Swami Sriyukteswar. And it was one of the most fascinating books I've ever read in my life. It's number one, it's very concise. And number two, it does a comparative analysis between the traditional Hindu values as advocated by Krishna and the Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita with the Christian ideologies that are the foundation of Judeo-Christian Western philosophy, and then identified where is the right life and right dwelling and nutritional support of the body, the astrological position of the universe, well, how the body works from an energetic perspective, how our senses work, how we misidentify things, how we identify things. And this little tiny book of 100 pages, like it's a tiny book, but it's so concise and precise. And one of the areas that he talked about was that a vegetarian diet was more suitable for advancement in consciousness or meditation. Well, as like, that was in conflict with many things that I had from my Western ideas, but I saw these comparison, which were, he was actually drawing similarities between Eastern and Western thinking, but here I'm left at the bottom of this performance-based diet, which is primarily based on macros. I've had tremendous amount of success as a bodybuilder. I've won, you know, various championships and stuff. I'm like, but it's against what everybody says. I'll run an experiment. So I went on a plant-based diet for 2 weeks. Didn't lose all my muscle mass and didn't blow away. I was like, okay, well, I'll try 2 weeks more. Felt pretty good. I said, I'll do another month. So I went 2 months on a completely plant-based diet. At the end of the second month, I think, I guess I'll never, I won't, I just don't, I'm going to have meat anymore. And stopped and never ate another piece of meat in the rest of my life. Now, I'm a guy going from literally, if it doesn't have meat in the meal, it's not right, to like completely dropping it in 2 months' time. Now, I do believe that the information created the possibility of that happening. And so if I'm dropping seeds here today to your listeners, I want to plant the seeds in your mind of potential. I'm not saying it's an absolute. I'm saying, hey, let's just suspend our disbelief. As opposed to a rigid position, which we know is not the right position if you're in martial arts, a rigid position is taken apart easily. You want to be flexible like bamboo. We want to expand our capabilities. We're going to drop a seed of, okay, that's a potential. I dropped a seed, I planted it. I felt great. Let's move forward. Then I got this idea. Well, wait a second. Now, I haven't actually competed on a bodybuilder. I had stopped competing for a while, and I thought, well, because all my performance based end, well, you can't be successful as a bodybuilder on a plant-based diet. Yep. And I'm like, well, do we actually know that that's true? Common common beliefs doesn't necessarily mean it's truthful, nor does success or failure in an endeavor related to dietary philosophy indicate that that dietary philosophy is the ultimate level of truth. It's a relative level. Mm. Well, let's run another experiment. Let's see if I can actually win a competition, or at least get in condition, a reasonable level of successful bodybuilding condition, a plant-based diet. And I did that. I went after it. And the next year I won my first competition and came second in the Western Canadians to what I feel was the best athlete at the time in all of Canada. And then I went another year and I won that competition. And then I won the national championship. And then I ended up at the Mr. Universe contest in Mumbai, India, on a plant-based diet. So right there, I was one of the few people in the history of the world that had actually competed at the Mr. Universe on a plant-based diet. I think there might have been, it's a handful of people who have done that. And I'm like, wow, that's interesting. But, and I want to put a big but, I was trying to apply in what I would call a meat-eating mentality to my plant-based performance diet. And so I had elements of mixing the two, and that set me up with some conflict, which led me to a raw food diet. And what happened was after the Mr. Universe contest, I gained 42 pounds of fat and water. I just went into this kind of inflammatory, now it's normal to gain a little bit of weight, but I just couldn't stop it. I was overeating. I was eating all these different foods I couldn't get. I couldn't fill myself up. It was a disaster. And I met a guy, I met a medical doctor named Dr. Michael O'Brien, and who changed my life. First off, he was in his late 70s. He was the epitome of health. He was super vibrant. His skin glowed. His eyes could look through. He gave an entire seminar of, it was well over 8 hours. He didn't take a break. He didn't stop for food. He didn't lose any of his cognitive capabilities. And I was like, this guy's amazing. And he talked about digestive health. He talked about the role of enzymes, the role of probiotics, how you had to get mucoid plaque out of your system, how toxins were disrupting your body. And I was like, well, and so he was on a raw food diet and he was supporting that raw food diet. And he had overcome cirrhosis of the liver and he'd overcome cancer. And he'd helped Bernard Jensen, who wrote the book on digestive health, recover from cancer late in his life, which is recorded in one of Jensen's last book called Come Alive. You can read that, how he overcome paralysis and death with the guidance of Dr. O'Brien. And I went up to him and I said, Dr. O'Brien, I can't figure this out. I've been on this diet. I went plant-based. I achieved the what's considered the aesthetic ideas of human physiology and aesthetic side. That's how one looks. And yet I've obviously missed something here. Like, you know, even though I got the best coach, I got this discipline, I'm following everything. What's going wrong? And he changed my life. And he says, Wade, you've learned to build the body from the outside in, not the inside out. I'll show you how to do that. And so I went on a completely raw food diet and I took a bunch of suggested herbal cleansers and micronutrients and vitamins and minerals and an array of enzymes and probiotics. And in 6 months, I recaptured my health. I recaptured my physique. Yet I had a new level of energy and vitality, and I'd say sensory perception that I didn't have prior to. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Now there was one small challenge. I noticed that I couldn't train as much or as frequently as I could before, that I would, my recovery wasn't better. Although I felt better, I felt I couldn't push myself the same way in the gym before. And I said, how am I going to do this? And so over the next 4 years, I began coaching clients all around the world. I'd started the company that was the precursor to Bioptimizers. It was called Masszymes Inc. We taught bodybuilders and athletes how to build performance-based lifestyle. And And then I was continually experimenting with plant-based and raw food diets, and sure enough, had success with that. I've had lots of challenges. I stayed completely raw food for 2 years. And then I went cyclic raw food, that I would add a little bit of cooked food, more from a social perspective than anything else. Sometimes it's difficult on a raw food diet socially. I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And I also found it was way easier in if I was in a warmer climate to maintain a raw food diet than it was to be in a hotter climate. And there's various things I've discovered about that. But ultimately, I got to the final thing. And then when I prepared for the 2007, I decided I'd make a comeback. And I did it on a completely raw food diet on an extreme level of training, won the national championship, and went back to the Natural Olympia on a raw food diet and competed on a raw food diet and placed fifth in the world, where I had 13th in the world before, and had achieved a physique that was comparable to my levels in 2003 when I competed at the Mr. Universe the first time. So I figured it out. And from that point, I started, I wrote some books on that. I had written some books around bodybuilding, sports forms, but I wrote some books and became well-known on the raw food circuit during that time and did all that sort of stuff. And I wouldn't say I'm a strong advocate for raw food or plant-based or anything else. I'm like, choose the diet that you want. But if you want to go down that road, there are a bunch of things that I suggest that people consider if they want to do that, how they can do that more successfully, what kind of things they need to support themselves with, and what things they might need if they're considering doing that on a performance base, athletic base, or in regards to building muscle mass or losing body fat. And so that's been the journey. And, and now I'll be turning 50 in a few weeks. And I'm the picture of health. I'm in extraordinary physical condition, and I feel very fortunate for the journey.
That's fantastic. And I think something I heard you say in an interview was that when you were competing on your diet, that a lot of the other guys you were competing with, they all looked good, but they were all having challenges. You were kind of happy and vibrant, and you didn't have the pains and things that then were suffering to get that physique and to get in that condition, and you weren't. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the problems of a high protein diet, which is common in that area, so the benefit of a high protein diet from performance physique advocacy, that's getting what I would call let's back up. First off, I want to be clear. Competing in a bodybuilding competition has nothing to do with health. There is a set of fitness prerogatives that are allowing you to treat less than healthy levels of body fat and excessive levels of muscularity in order to achieve an aesthetic idea. Okay. All athletics are performance-based, where fitness is a part of it, but are not necessarily healthy. It's not healthy to go play American football and smash into each other. It's not healthy to figure skate every day and, you know, do quads and land on your back when you're injured. All athletics involve a certain amount of health challenges in the pursuit of fitness or performance, fitness being a component of performance. So in bodybuilding, you want to treat an aesthetic ideal, low body fat levels, high levels of muscularity, symmetry, shape, all these kind of performance. And in order to do that, a lot of people will advocate high protein diets. And they might either do a medium protein, high fat diet and low carbohydrate, or the other method is to do high protein, high carbohydrate, low fat. Those are the two basic ways. And depending on genetics and variants, you might choose one over the other at any given time. Fine. Now, here I was going at it with moderate protein or low, what would be considered low protein, moderate carbohydrates from sources that aren't usually sourced on that, moderate levels of fat or low fat, certainly definitely low in saturated fat, which has another correlative challenge. And like, this is just the antithesis to that mentality. And that's why people said this isn't possible. And for the most part, they would be right. Now, I was able to develop proteolytic enzymes that allowed me to extract more amino acids out of the food that I was getting. And conversely, with my competitors, with high protein diets, the advantage of it is it's high satiety. One of the things that you have to fight with in order to hit that levels of body fat is a continuous state of hunger, especially as you get close to the contest. Right. And that has mental effects. You can be, you know, can be mentally challenged. You can be disciplined. And you oftentimes will have dysbiosis in the guts, where undigested proteins start to leak in the system. And that causes an inflammatory response in the body. So that in itself can be extremely challenging, and that leads to you know, joint pain, brain fog, low energy, things like that, which are common with bodybuilders. Now, when I had my low protein content and was able to extract maximum amount of amino acids with very little undigested proteins going into my system, I could eat 85 grams of protein at a weight of, say, 175, 180 pounds, where my competitors would be eating 200, 250 grams of protein. So the efficiency of my digestion allowed me to get more amino acids, because you really want amino acids to recover. And then they might have been getting on eating a couple hundred grams of protein a day. And that was that was what allowed me to become successful on a raw food diet. The sources of plant-based proteins that I was using, the digestive aids in proteolytic enzymes, as well as proteolytic probiotics to ensure I was getting all the amino acids without tripwire. And because I had that, I didn't have the brain fog. I didn't have the low energy. I was able to achieve the very low levels of body fat, which are performance-based requirements of that sport. But the good news was, is I had a level of health and vitality that my competitors didn't have. And so that was not easy to get there. It took me 4 years, 15,000 clients I coached over that time, and to figure out these parameters. And then I had to develop an array of enzymatic and proteolytic solutions over and above what I learned from Dr. O'Brien, who dealt mostly in illness conditions. And we were dealing this as a performance-based. And I figured that one out and became relatively successful in that. And it's like, okay, we solved that challenge. And that was the door opener to say, there's a lot more to diet than what has been advocated to what I call dietary tribalism. In other words, a given diet can be successful for a certain group of people, and it'll be unsuccessful for another group of people. Well, why is that? And then I looked at why fasting had a long history of helping people healing. And the elements that make fasting successful and the elements that will generate people to go to certain types of diets are actually related to digestive capabilities inside the body, whether they've been compromised or not compromised. And that's what determines how one becomes successful on a given diet. So any given diet, you need to understand how you're digesting, absorbing, and utilizing the nutrients of that diet. And you can tweak it in various ways, using specific aids relative to your individual genetics, lifestyles, and goals to optimize that. And of course, that's what led to the company we call today as Bioptimizers.
So what was a typical, when you were training as on a raw food diet, what was your typical day in terms of eating and training? How did that look like at the time?
Well, what was fascinating about it is, so this is going to be kind of wild for people. I haven't really revealed a lot of it. I was going along and I had been kind of advancing my meditative practice, and under an unusual set of circumstances, I had a vision of myself competing again, which I had retired years ago and had no desire, but it kept popping up in my vision. So I said, well, there is a contest coming, a national championship in 3.5 weeks, which the normal preparation for a diet for a contest is somewhere between 12 and 20. So training to be fit and training for a competition are two very different. They're diametrically different. And I was like, well, that's not even possible. But I thought, well, what if I started combining? What if I did this? What if I did a raw food diet and I crammed literally 4 months of training into just under 4 weeks? What would that look like? And what would I need to do? And so I did it. I went on a ridiculous, and I don't think this is a, this, so this piece isn't sustainable. I want to be clear about that right now, but this was under very tight circumstances. I was running a holistic health clinic, so I had access to a hyperbaric chamber, an infrared sauna. I was using a rebounder. I was consuming about 2 gallons of ionized water every day, boosted with ionic minerals. I was training 3 times a day in weight workouts, 5 rebounding sessions, sleeping in the hyperbaric chamber, doing the infrared sauna, running electromagnetic frequencies through the body, and consuming a raw food diet in order to do that particular process. And I was able to stay within that parameter for that period of time. Once I won the national championship, I down-regulated the training frequency to twice per day with a long cardio, like cardio session. When I say cardio, it was just really slow walking so I wouldn't overtax my body, and continued on the raw food diet for the next 3 months and before I competed at the world championships. So I think I'm the only person to have actually competed drug-free at both the Mr. Universe and the natural Mr. Olympia on a plant-based and then a raw food, like on a raw food diet. I think I'm the only guy that's ever done that. So it was odd. So I want to be clear about all of the other things that were augmenting that. And then my raw food diet, my protein sources came from pumpkin, pea, and hemp protein. So I would grind those together because at that time there was no availability of those things. So I would literally grind those up myself. And I was living in Vancouver, Canada, which was one of the epicenters of the hemp protein market. And so I was lucky at the time because this was way back in 07. And I had been using hemp protein, then I had added pea protein and pumpkin to boost up the amino acid content and the profile a little bit. And then I was mixing in raw cacao into that to make it a kind of a chocolatey flavor or whatever. And then I was eating, you know, vegetables, northern berries, and you know, a little bit of raw pressed hemp oil for fat. So I was using the hemp oil, which was a good blend of 369s to keep my saturated fats, to keep my hormones stabilized, because that's an issue on a raw food diet. If you want, you really got to pay attention to your saturated fats to manufacture your hormone capabilities. And then low glycemic type carbohydrates, fruits, berries, things like that. And then, you know, post-workout, I would have maybe 6 dates in conjunction with my, you know, because I want a little bit of more faster acting carbohydrates. And that's how I did it. I had a very low calories for the day. It was approximately 1500, which was a severe calorie deficit because I was probably burning 3000 a day. And really, you'd only have 1000 calorie deficit at the most for a male and 500 generally for a female. And I was really pushing the envelope, but I was also bolstering my life with those other elements that gave me that extra 500 calorie window. I don't recommend that. I just want to be clear to people as a long-term strategy for health and vitality. I think that would be counterproductive, but it was what I needed to do to be at a world championship level under that time.
Prior to you, I guess you might have looked into this, is there any history of vegan, vegetarian, raw food bodybuilders? Maybe not 100%, but has that been a part of the bodybuilding world at all in the past?
The only person that I'm cognitively aware that had a tremendous amount of success as a vegetarian was Bill Pearl. He wrote a great book called Keys to the Inner Universe. He's in his 90s now, and an extraordinary physique. Now, unlike myself, Bill Pearl had extraordinary genetics for bodybuilding. He was a naturally muscular guy and built muscle relatively easy, and had phenomenal physical capabilities. He also became a success later on after he retired. He also became a successful cyclist. And he's a very interesting character, actually. His book, Keys to the Inner Universe, and his other book, Beyond the Universe, are beautiful books. Not only, he also has a spiritual teacher from India who has helped him in his meditation, and he lives a kind of almost monastic style, mystical life in Oregon. And he's a very interesting character to get into all that stuff. And then there was another athlete, I believe, by the name of Andreas Kaling, who was a vegetarian that had competed at the Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia. Now, of course, Bill Pearl says that he wasn't using anabolic steroids. Kaling never said that. I think that he probably was, based on his physique and where he was. And then myself, I wasn't using anabolics. And that's a big factor also in the support of muscle tissue. So if I, for example, right now I'm at a body weight of around 180 pounds at 5'8", single digit body fat levels, which is about my peak that I can achieve for someone my age on a drug-free body, bodybuilding type style of training and diet. And I have a business now, so it's not as focused as before. But if I was to say add even testosterone replacement at my age, because my testosterone levels are declining as they do as they age, I would probably be 7 to maybe 15 pounds heavier. My weight would probably be in the high 180s to mid 190s just on testosterone replacement alone, because of the anabolics. And if I was on anabolics, my body weight would probably be anywhere from 205, maybe even as high as 218, 220. It would probably be that. Which, if you actually look at muscle mass, you know, someone my size probably has 65 pounds of actual muscle tissue that's in the lean body mass. If you're doing a DEXA scan with bone, organs, maybe 65 pounds of muscle tissue. So to add an extra 10 pounds of muscle tissue or 15 pounds of muscle tissue would actually represent a 20 to 35% difference in muscle mass, which is the difference between natural bodybuilders and athletes who are not. And then, of course, when you go into the highest levels of performance, you know, with the current Mr. Olympias today, they're probably carrying literally double the amount of muscle, and sometimes maybe even triple if you get to the top ranks of that, than a regular person. And that's why they look extraordinarily different than the average population. And they're doing that through chemicalization in order to support that. So
it does seem like what bodybuilders do, I mean, I don't know as much about it as you obviously, but it does seem like quite a big risk. Some of them have not, seems like haven't done very well afterwards in terms of their health. Not just, I guess, the diet, but the physical excesses of certain things that they've done and the exercise. I seem to have seen some of them have either not lasted very long, longevity-wise, or they've had damage. Have you seen any of that? And what do you think about that?
Well, I always say to people, are you a fan of, say, Formula One racing? One of my favorite athletes was a fellow by the name of Ayrton Senna, oftentimes considered one of the greatest, you know, drivers ever. Sure. He ended up dead from his career. If you look at the average career of an NFL football player, which is very popular, one of the most popular sports in the world, the Super Bowl being probably the most watched sporting event in the world, I think the average lifespan of an NFL football player is in the mid 50s. A lineman, for example, is in the equivalent of 10 to 12,000 car crashes. If you look at the Dubin Inquiry, which investigated Olympic athleticism after the Ben Johnson tested positive for steroids, and Linford Christie, the British athlete, later said, well, I wish all of the athletes' halos would fall down and choke them, because everybody was on performance-enhancing drugs at that 100-meter final at that time. But Johnson was obviously tested positive, and the Inquiry did some interesting thing. I had a professor on that Inquiry, and he said, well, you know, they did a survey of these Olympics, and I believe the numbers, and I'm paraphrasing here, so I might be somewhat off, but it was about this, that they polled the athletes and they said, if you could take a drug that would not be detected and you would win the gold medal for sure, but you had a 95% chance of dying in the next 5 years, would you do it? And the answer was, most of them said yes. Wow. Almost every one of the athletes said yes. So when you are looking in a magazine at Mr. Olympias or race car drivers or top MMA fighters or whatever the sport might be, if you look at cycling, you know, with the Tour de France, when erythropoietin was invented, I think it was in excess of almost 30 athletes died the first time that they started using, because their blood was turning to molasses, the most cardiovascularly advanced athletes in the world. So it's not a good comparison to look at the top level of any sports, which is are going to be 5 and 6 sigmas away from the population, and classify that sport as unhealthy.
Right.
Because the funnel that a person is looking at is an issue. Now, what I will say is that when the 1990s came around and Dorian Yates came into the scene, who became was an extraordinary athlete out of Birmingham, England, and he ushered in what most people called the mass monsters, and started using a variety of chemicals and agents and stuff like that. And I ran into Dorian recently, and he's certainly a transformed and interesting person. The same thing that led him to end his career due to injuries from his training. You know, now he's does a great cardio program, but he take that same attitude and applied it to his spiritual realization, and he's become a just an extraordinary human. So he's an extraordinary person, but that ushered in to what you indicated, a whole array of people who were building a lot of muscle, excessive amounts of muscle, which is against our evolutionary survival dynamics from longevity, energy expansion, the laws of thermodynamics, the support of muscle mass and the reduction of body fat. Those are all counter to evolutionary biology. So the bodybuilder per se is the original biohacker who is going against evolutionary biology to achieve a certain outcome.
I was wondering, this is something that I've always thought, and I don't have a lot of experience with any of this stuff, but I've always wondered, what do you think is worse for a person's health? Or what do you think, if there are problems with athletes and high level athletes having, you know, having damage to their health over the long term, is it the, say, like the anabolics or the other chemicals that they might take? Or is it actually the diet? Because I've always thought that the diet they're doing must be pretty bad. So like the very high protein diet for the performance, or is it just a mixture of all of it? Is it a part of that picture that's the worst part of it?
My belief, and keep in mind, I've been studying this now for 35 years. Mm-hmm. So, and I have a number of colleagues who are professional bodybuilders, and all of them will tell you, the most challenging part of the sport is the diet that's related to it. And I would draw an example to bodybuilders and NFL linemen, and then sumo wrestlers. Sumo wrestlers die mostly before the age of 40, certainly before the age of 40. The life expectancy of a sumo wrestler is about half the age of a Japanese citizen.
Wow.
Okay. And they have to eat very special things to achieve high levels of muscle mass and body fat, Well, linemen, NFL linemen are involved in also eating a tremendous amount of food to support that. They also have a low life expectancy in the mid 50s. And then you have bodybuilders who many die early or certainly don't have a life expectancy that extends beyond the average citizen, which you would think they're practicing all these exercise components. And I'm talking about professional level caliber athletes. But all of them say the same thing. The hardest part of their sport is the consumption of the food to support that level of muscle mass and that level of exercise output. And I believe that all disease begins in the gut. I believe that the overstuffing of the system with tremendous amounts of food puts strain on that. And that's why I began to implement regular fasting into my diet, lowering my caloric intake, moving away from animal-based proteins. And if we look at Bill Pearl, who's in his 90s, plant-based guy, meditative guy, didn't do the drugs and has extended his life above and beyond, as have many of his students who have extraordinary levels of health on a plant-based diet. So to me, although the jury's not out, and I'll get back to you when I hit 100, I think that there are clues here that are leading to me that it's the digestive stress that is contributing to the problems. And if you add anabolics or various other chemicals, then you're amplifying your risk profile for the person for sure.
Yeah, this is really interesting. Thanks for that, Wade. I guess I was wondering if you think that that's one of the reasons, like if someone was to say, we don't see as many raw or plant-based, you know, bodybuilders, as part of that, I was wondering if it's in conflict in a sense with the dietary philosophy. Like a lot of people that are getting into plant-based and into raw foods are looking at it through the health perspective, and that there's a conflict there, as you were kind of saying, between health and performance.
Yes, absolutely. Health and performance are not the same aspects. And one of the things we identified in our book, Sick to Superhuman by Optimizers, is we have a triangle. And in that triangle, there's three general areas that people are moving towards. One is aesthetics, one is performance, and one is health. Now, aesthetics, creating an aesthetically pleasing physique, which is usually to support propagation of the species by being better from an athletic type of selection, which leads people or the opposite sex to believe that you might have better genes to pass on into the future. It's a completely biological observational drive, which has been proven over and over by, you know, social media, dating apps and things like that. And so that's pretty evident. And people can call it vanity or people can say I'm doing it for this, but that's really the driver. The second thing, performance-based. Well, maybe people derive a lot of pleasure, like I do. I love going to the gym and working out. I love the feeling of that. I love the progressive nature, and it's a way to keep healthy in a technologically advanced world. I just enjoy the process. I have a friend who loves long-distance running. Now, and he runs every day. He gets up at really early every day and runs every day and working some manual labor job and is very fit on a cardiovascular level. So if you look at those two areas, they're both performance-based in completely different parameters, but it's the way that we achieve a certain level of fitness. Now, there is a point, and I would say if you look at Peter Attia, the longevity expert, medical doctor, he relates that cardiovascular fitness, if you can take it to the top 2.5 percentile, okay, which you're not into, say, a high performance level that would be competitive on a national scale and endurance training, but you have that high level fitness, that seems to be the cardiovascular threshold. If you look at longevity studies from muscle mass and its ability to maintain longevity, if that's your goal, you're probably around that 2.5 percentile again. So you want more muscle mass than, say, a natural person. You want better cardiovascular things. And you could probably go to flexibility. If you got into that 2.5 range of gain of flexibility, your mobility would probably be the best. And so I think those three parameters would constitute how you're going to live well, have to live strong, and have a high level of performance, maybe not at a competitive nature, but certainly in for an extension of life. And that's going to lead to generalized health. And then your diet should be designed to offset the genetic risks that you carry with for your thing so that you don't turn on the epigenetic switches. That's how I look at the whole profile now that I'm 50. When I was 20, I didn't care about many of those things. I just wanted as much muscle mass as possible. And so I think balance comes over time, but balance is often achieved by being disbalanced at periods of your life in order to bring it back into the whole. And so that's how I look at it. And I think to kind of circle around to raw food diets, because I think that was the original design. We went off on major tangents. Where do I feel raw food diets fit into this whole genre? My experience across the board is that most people on the planet will do very well by engaging for a raw food diet for a period of 6 weeks to 3 months every single year. Depending on where you are climate-wise, you may be able to sustain that for a long period of time, like indefinitely, if you are addressing the limitations that that diet might present. You might be able to do a partially raw food diet. And I would say what would be my level of raw food diet today? Probably 70%, 60 to 70% of the food I consume is raw food. 30% is cooked. Probably could go as high as an 80-20 if you wanted to be disciplined. I think I could eat a still a little bit more raw food diet. The other 20%, I believe the social benefits that are required and some of the convenience are beneficial for me. And then periods of complete food restriction or raw foodism is something I incorporate on a psychic level in my lifestyle, because I just find I feel good on it. I like that feeling. And it's a way to recalibrate my senses, my awareness, my health, my vitality, reset my metabolism, my apostat, as well as reduce any cravings for foods that aren't supportive of my lifestyle. And that's how I fit that into my whole life.
Amazing, amazing. And it's really interesting that it seems like your journey towards changing your diet wasn't as much related with health issues. You've not really brought up that you had major health issues, but you were, obviously you read the book, The Holy Science, and you were actually looking for I guess more energy and also the progression, the spiritual progression aspect of it. So has that been a major motivator for you in trying to stay healthy, and do those things go together as well?
Yeah. The one thing I can absolutely attest to of engaging in a mostly or completely raw food diet, sensory acuity without exception goes up, and it's very noticeable inside of that, your sensitivity to foods, to environment. Now, in a highly technological world, that can actually be detrimental to your culture. And I would say that if you're going to maintain that diet, you're probably going to have to move to a more rural, peaceful setting. I think you're probably going to be moved towards a more ascetic, lifestyle. And that is ascetic, ascetic, as in asceticism or mysticism. And I think there are significant that in itself is a performance-based diet. It's performance to the reduction of stimulation in the nervous system of the body, which was indicated also in the Holy Science. Eating less, eating more natural food states, moving one's life to a more rural and subtle setting where the overload of overt sensations are limited, so that you can tap into the more finer elements of human spirit, consciousness, and things like that. And so I do believe that that is a pathway to that. It's not an absolute, but I think it certainly can help in those areas. And that's been my experience.
Well, let's get on then to what you're doing now. And you obviously went from bodybuilding and personal training, and you started, I believe, a number of companies and been very successful at that. Do you want to talk about that whole journey and what you guys do and what you offer, how you help people?
Yeah, so my company is called bioptimizers.com. Inside that, people go to my site, I give away an awesome health course, which is a 12 week, 84 days. The 84 days, and it's 5 to 15 minute videos, which gives me the entire parameters for health: air, water, exercise, sunlight, cellular optimizers, mental beliefs and attitudes, education, testing, coaching, all of the components that I learned over the entire life compressed into a systematized course of application. We don't even get to diet till far into the course because we've got to get the foundations of air, water, and movement, which I think are a priori to diet as far as living long, living strong, and living your best life. And then we get into the nuances of that based on the individual. So that's that. Bioptimizers.com, of course, I did run into challenges. I gained all that weight after the Mr. Universe, 40 pounds of fat and water in 11 weeks. And when I recovered, I was able to optimize my digestion. And since that time, we've been building digestive health aids, which are used by virtually all the top biohackers in the world. Are an advocate. We have a research facility in Sarajevo, Croatia, Birch International University, where we have 13 PhDs and master students who are working daily to see how nutrients and vitamins and minerals and what type of enzymes work best and how we can feed probiotics for them to produce interesting nutrients. And we put that into our dietary aids for people because digestion is a big problem with chemicalization of the world. It's almost everybody has compromised digestion to various degrees. It's why they select certain diets, and it's why they need digestive aids now in order to optimize their digestion because chemicalization has become so deep and extensive. And then we also developed a magnesium supplementation to augment the massive magnesium deficiency in the world. We have the world's best magnesium. Certainly, it's one of the most best-selling and successful magnesiums ever created, 7 different types of magnesiums. And then we've got another company, which is in cognitive enhancement called Nootopia, where we are optimizing the neurochemistry of people's brains to allow them to achieve different brain states virtually at will through an array of nutritional supplementation. And then, you know, we write books, courses, educations. I have a podcast because the Altsome Health podcast. We have a bio tribe where we kind of exchange ideas in a Facebook group. And I just did a seminar last night, which is great on these things. And yeah, that's kind of what we do. And that's how we go at it. And it's a lot of fun. And I love helping people. We've literally helped tens of thousands of people literally every month now live a better life. And that feels really good.
That's fantastic. Wade, how would people, so BioOptor, is that the best place for?
Yeah, just go to bioptimizers.com. That'll get you in there. If you want to try any of our products, you can put lovefruit10. We get a 10% discount. You go to bioptimizers.co.uk. If you're in the UK, our partners over there are awesome. You get that discount code, and we give a money-back guarantee on every single product that we offer for 365 days. If it doesn't work, if it doesn't blow your mind, if it isn't better than everything you have, you get, we'll refund all your money to de-risk it because it's our service to you to keep on experimenting.
Thank you very much, Wade. I was wondering if we could finish off, if you could give some advice for people that are starting off, whether that's in physical fitness or in just the diet or in health. For the beginners, what would be your advice? But also for the people who are already on this journey and maybe on a bodybuilding journey and want to take it to the next level. Maybe you can leave us with some last minute advice for those two types.
I'll be real quick because I got to jump on another podcast, but I would say open your mind. Don't take a rigid position. Follow a mentor, someone who's producing the results that you want to do. Experiment for a period of 3 months to a year before moving on at least to another mentor. And then play with contra narratives to your health. Don't just assume because you read something or heard something or saw success in someone else that that naturally applies to you. Or conversely, just because someone condemns a certain area doesn't mean that that's not right for you. And so try to remain flexible, open, experiment, find mentorship. It's the fastest way to cut the learning curve and never stop learning. And you'll make the journey enjoyable as opposed to being conflictive, which so many people are doing today.
Thank you so much for joining us, Wade, and everyone who's watching and listening. Please feel free to like, share, subscribe, and check out BioOptimizers. And we'll see you in the next episode of the Love Fruit podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Take care. Have a great day.